All right, folks, welcome back to the Honors Element. I'm Ben, sitting here with Morgan, as always, and today we're going to dive into the nitty-gritty of how atoms actually build up, especially when you get into the transition metals and all those weird exceptions. Morgan, you remember how last time we leaned hard on that off-bow principle? Electrons fill up in the order of lowest available energy, right? First S, then P, then D, in that tidy order.
Yeah, but tidy order only holds as long as the sublevel energies play along. Once you move into the transition metals, especially starting with potassium and calcium, things go a bit sideways. The reason is shown in the spectroscopy. The 4s and 3d sublevels are basically neck and neck in energy.
That's why for potassium, it fills 4s before 3d, so you get the noble gas configuration of argon with an additional 4s election. And calcium goes to 4s too, but as you move past calcium, suddenly for scandium and beyond, the electrons prefer being in the 3d more than the 4s.
Some of those classic exceptions are chromium and copper. Chromium is the poster child for breaking the rules. Instead of having valence electrons of 4s2 and 3d4, it goes has 4s1 and 3d5. Same idea for copper. You'd expect 4s2, 3d9, but what you actually get is 4s1, 3d10.
Right, but there's actually decent energy logic behind it if you look deeper. The 3D orbital is pretty localized compared to 4S, so the electron-electron repulsions get intense if you double up too much in 3D. When you let the electrons spread out, like half-filling or fully filling a D subshell, as in chromium and copper, it actually stabilizes the atom thanks to those exchange energy effects, even though it seems to break the off-bow principle. The electrons basically say, I know what the rules are, but trust me, this is more comfortable.
Yeah, and you see similar anomalies in heavier elements, like ruthenium in the fifth period. The important thing is that these exceptions aren't random. They come from the delicate balance of sublevel energy, electron-electron repulsion, and sometimes relativistic effects way down the table.
And I think this is an awesome example for why chemistry can be frustrating and beautiful, because it's not always as straightforward as plugging electrons into buckets. Sometimes electrons get clever. And I guess the big message is, when you see exceptions, it's usually the result of deeper energetic trade-offs among the subshells.
So Ben, I feel like talking about these exceptions and filling orders is great, but it can sound a little abstract. Like, how do we actually know where these electrons are?
That's where photoelectron spectroscopy comes in. Photoelectron spectroscopy, or PES, is kind of a reality check for our models. Basically, you shine light, like UV or X-rays, on a gas of atoms, and the energy knocks electrons out. By measuring the energy of those ejected electrons, you get direct evidence of the energy levels in the atom.
And I think what's wild is that the data let you map out which electrons are easier or harder to remove. Like, you get peaks in the PES spectrum that correspond to electrons in different subshells. Some are way deeper and some right on the edge. For example, neon shows 3 clear energy levels. The 2p electrons need the least energy to pop out, the 2s are deeper, and the 1s are way down. And you can actually measure this.
Right, and that lines up with the calculated configurations. For neon, you see energy peaks at 21.6 electron volts, 48.4 electron volts, and then there's this huge drop to the core 1s at 870.2 electron volts. Those big jumps basically confirm that electrons organize themselves into shells and subshells, and that shells farther from the nucleus, the valence shells, are much easier to ionize. It's also where that one Rydberg energy boundary comes in. Everything less negative than about one Rydberg, or around 13.6 electron volts, is commonly considered valence. Core electrons are buried deeper below that point.
But it's not always neat, is it? Sometimes photoelectron spectroscopy data actually challenge our simple buildup rules. Like, the splitting between 3D and 4S energies in transition metals is small, and PES shows you that 3D electrons are not as core-like as you'd expect. In fact, in those transition metals, the D electrons behave as valence electrons. The spectra prove it.
And that evidence is why, for the first row transition metals, those d electrons get counted as valence. Photoelectron spectroscopy basically says, hey, those d electrons are still available for chemistry, which is neat because it also explains why transition metals do all sorts of complex chemistry. They have more electrons that can get involved in bonding compared to, say, the main group elements.
Definitely. And if you're ever in doubt about what's really going on inside an atom, go look for the spectrum. The periodic table and electron configurations aren't just conventions. They're backed up by this kind of experimental data.
Let's bring this all back around to the periodic trends. So, atomic radius first. As you move left to right across a period, atoms get smaller. Why? Because with every step to the right, you add a proton and an electron to the same shell, but the electrons can't shield each other well. So, the effective nuclear charge pulls them in tighter.
Exactly. And down a group, the atomic radius increases because you're filling new shells farther from the nucleus. Plus, all those inner electrons shield the outer ones from the nucleus, so they feel less pull. For ionic radii, it kind of follows. Cations shrink compared to their atoms, and anions puff up a bit, since adding electrons increases electron-electron repulsion.
It's all about the balance between more protons and imperfect screening. Okay, so ionization energy, the energy it takes to remove an electron from an atom or ion in its gas phase, increases left to right. This is because electrons are held more tightly. But there are those dips where you'd expect a nice climb, like in oxygen or sulfur compared to their neighbors. That's because of electron repulsion in paired orbitals, making them a hair easier to remove than you'd think. Remember, there's a special stability associated with half-filled subshells.
And then, going down a group, ionization energy generally drops because the valence electron is farther out and easier to snatch away. But, as you said earlier, even here, there are exceptions. Gold's first ionization energy is higher than copper or silver, which helps explain why gold is so unreactive. It just hangs on to its electrons.
Electron affinity is the energy released or absorbed when a neutral atom in the gaseous state gains an electron, generally tracks with ionization energy, but shifted one spot over. Usually adding an electron is easier as you go across a period, but there are again important exceptions. The noble gases, for instance, don't even make stable anions in the gas phase. And for elements like bromine versus selenium, electron affinity for bromine is much higher since that extra electron creates a closed shell that's super stable.
And this really all comes back to electron configuration and effective nuclear charge. The big ideas, atomic size, ionization energy, electron affinity, those are all about how electrons are arranged and how strongly the nucleus can reach those outer shells, especially when the core electrons are screening some of that pull. Just like we saw with C versus Br, the more incomplete the shielding and the higher the charge, the stronger the pull.
Yeah, it really ties together everything we've covered in these past few episodes. From quantum mechanics to periodic trends, it's all about where those electrons are and how they interact. Morgan, I think we've given everyone plenty to chew on, don't you?
I'd say so. We'll unpack more nuance in future episodes. But for now, thanks for listening to the Honors Element. Ben, have a great week, and let's talk soon.
Thanks, Morgan, and thanks to everyone tuning in. Keep asking questions, and see you next time.